Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine, who reflects on events of the past year since the September 11th terrorist strikes and the ongoing debate on American values during this time of crisis. Sally Booker, executive director of Africa Action, who assesses the outcome of the World Summit on Sustainable Development, which concluded in Johannesburg, South Africa on September 4th. And Sherry Herndon of the Indie Media Network, who discusses the Reclaim the Media convergence coinciding with the annual meeting of the National Association of Broadcasters in Seattle, September 10th through the 15th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The World Press Review reports that Peru's President Alejandro Toledo has retreated from his pledge to privatize state-run companies. In response to major unrest in the southern city of Arequipa, Toledo has killed the plan to sell two power companies to the Belgian firm Tractebel for $167 million. The announcement of the deal in April led to massive protests, including a wave of violent incidents that left hundreds of people injured and $100 million in damages. Toledo was selling the two profitable power companies to meet the privatization demands of the International Monetary Fund as part of Peru's $1.7 billion privatization effort. Opposition was also fueled by the feeling that Tractebel, the only bidder for the two companies, had gotten a sweetheart deal with the government. In addition, Toledo faces the growing frustration of Peru's poor, who account for 55% of the population, and growing fears about losing jobs and rising power prices. Toledo's popularity rating has been falling for months. Last summer, he enjoyed a 60% approval rating. By June, it had fallen to 16%. Movements opposing privatization and neoliberal economic policy pushed by Washington have been growing throughout Latin America in recent years. California Governor Gray Davis is a driven political fundraiser, amassing $50 million in his coffers in anticipation of a tough re-election fight this November. Davis had enough cash to spend $12 million in TV ads during the Republican primary that sunk the political hopes of former Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon. Instead, the GOP nominated underfunded conservative Bill Simon, who has been hurt by a $78 million civil fraud fine against his investment firm. For Davis, fundraising can be an obsession. The governor made a point during a policy discussion with the California Teachers Association to ask for a $1 million political contribution. Union President Wayne Johnson was shocked. Activist Harvey Rosenfeld remarked, "For Gray Davis, being governor is just a hobby, something he does a couple of hours a week. He spends the rest of his time raising money." Davis has been criticized for taking donations from some of the worst corporate abusers, including Enron, WorldCom, Global Crossing, and Adelphia. Many progressives are upset about Davis's close ties with the state prison guard union and the governor's strong support for the harsh three strikes law. Some Democrats, like former state senator Tom Hayden, are ignoring the governor's race and working to elect more progressives to the state legislature. Hayden concluded, "That is a much better hope to get the policy changes we want." Mother Jones magazine reports that ailing technology companies are looking to cash in on the booming homeland security budget. Software giant Cbell Systems recently ran an aggressive multimedia campaign with the slogan, "Who are the Mohammed Attas of tomorrow?" The ads promoted Cbell's new data-sharing product designed to combat terrorism. Other tech giants like Oracle and Sun Microsystems have also made a play for the $30 billion in Homeland Security funds since the September 11th attacks. Smaller firms like InVision, which makes explosive detection systems, has been able to stay in business because of the new attention to airport security. Oracle founder Larry Ellison presented one of the boldest plans. The software mogul wants Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge to create a national database that links government information with data such as thumbprints and iris scans. The idea will lead to a national identification card, a proposal that has long been opposed by defenders of civil liberties. Credit card bureaus and financial services companies are urging that the 1970 Fair Credit Reporting Act be rewritten to allow information sharing with agencies like the Federal Aviation Administration. The measure would also make it easier to sell personal data to insurance companies and direct marketers. Watchdog groups like the Electronic Privacy Information Center say that such a database could be used to profile people with questionable patterns in their credit histories and trigger many unwarranted terrorism investigations. Critics note that 30% of the data in credit reports is usually wrong. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Americans gather together in small towns and large cities across the nation on September 11th to remember and mourn the enormous loss of life and destruction wrought by last year's terrorist assaults on New York City and Washington, D.C. But while religious leaders led prayer services and politicians honored the hundreds of firefighters and police officers who sacrificed their lives to save others, the Bush administration was working hard to shape public opinion in support of a new war against Iraq. On this first anniversary of the September 11th attacks, people from all walks of life are contemplating the consequences of President Bush's declaration of a war without end. Many Americans flew flags displaying their patriotism, while others were drawn to hundreds of peace vigils, concerts, and educational forums which focused more on reconciliation than retribution. One of the largest of these gatherings was held in San Francisco's Golden State Park, where more than 20,000 people turned out for the 9/11 Power to the Peaceful Festival. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine, who reflects on events of the past year since September 11th and the ongoing debate on American values during this time of crisis.
I think September 11th is a teachable moment. I think it could be a doorway transformation, or it could just be an excuse for entrenching us in some of our worst instincts and habits. In many ways, our illusions of invulnerability were shattered on September 11th. We joined the world, and sadly for most people in the world who live in places like Sarajevo or Jerusalem or El Salvador or Cape Town, South Africa, this kind of unexpected and random, horrible violence that would take loved ones away, that's not a new experience for many of the world's people. But for us in the U.S., it was. I live in a terrorist target, Scott. I live 20 blocks from the White House. So that would be pretty high on the list of further attacks from Al-Qaeda cells or whoever is out there. And yet, and every time I leave Washington, I'm aware of my four-year-old son, who I just put to bed, and my wife, Joy. If they're not traveling with me, they're left behind for a night or two, as I'm out speaking somewhere. And I'm very aware of that, you know. But I don't want to respond to that very real threat in a way that threatens other people's four-year-olds.
There was enormous goodwill around the world, empathy and solidarity for the American people after the incredible loss of life from the September 11th attacks. Many folks' assessment is that solidarity has disappeared. It's dried up in the past year. I wanted to get your take on that. You think the world views the United States the same way it did 1 year ago?
Well, I just came back from Britain. My wife is English, and we were over in London. And I think there was tremendous sympathy and real feeling the pain of the American people during that period. But because of some of what we've done since, particularly now because of this threatened war with Iraq, which I found very little support for in Britain, actually, even though Tony Blair is supporting George Bush, in England there is very little support for a war against Iraq. And many of the cabinet ministers and members of parliament, the churches are all against it. The new Archbishop of Canterbury is totally opposed. I spent some time with him. And people feel like he said it well. His name is Rowan Williams. You're going to hear from him. He's 53 years old, the new Archbishop of Canterbury. And he said it well. He said, when all you have is hammers, everything looks like a nail. And America has the biggest and best hammers. It's all we seem to have and know how to use. And we have this illusion that by pounding one more nail, we can end this threat of terrorism. And Saddam Hussein is a nail we want to pound now. And I think Iraq is a very real threat indeed, with weapons of mass destruction and all the rest. The question is war the answer? And I think it's not. And I think when the world sees us talking about preemptive strikes against sovereign nations, violating international law, perhaps causing much more harm than good, taking a real problem and making it worse, I think that's the feeling I get in Europe. I think, you know, a nation that decides to go it alone and not to seek broader collaboration with the international community makes people fearful, whether it be climate control or chemical weapons protocols or the world court. We are seemingly moving away from closer cooperation with the rest of the world.
Reverend Jim Wallace, U.S. foreign policy over the past year has been driven by the idea that we have to prevent future terrorist attacks, hence the war in Afghanistan. What, in your view, have been the successes and failures of U.S. foreign policies post-September 11th?
Well, I often, when I'm out speaking on this topic, I often ask a question of the audience. I say, if the United States and its allies were able to kill every terrorist, incarcerate or kill every terrorist by the end of the day, today, how many of you think that terrorism would end? And you know, no one has ever raised their hand. I think there are cells of trained, ready, committed terrorists in the world, people who were ready to commit more violence against innocent people. I think that is a threat, but somehow we've got to deal with more of the root causes and not just the terrorists themselves. Poverty is not the only cause of terrorism, to be sure, but poverty and hopelessness are the best recruiters for terrorism. And unless we can begin to move toward a kind of multinational effort that really will, what I often call, to drain the swamps of injustice in which the mosquitoes of terrorism breed, we have to really combat that hopelessness and poverty. That is the best friend for those who want to commit terrorist violence.
That was Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners magazine. Contact Sojourners by calling area code 202-328-8842 or visit their website at www.sojo.net. After 10 days of debate, deliberation, and protest, the World Summit on Sustainable Development came to a close in Johannesburg, South Africa on September 4th. Although there were some areas of agreement, many of the 40,000 participants felt that the conference failed to advance the commitments made at the Rio Earth Summit a decade earlier. Delegates in Johannesburg, including 100 heads of state, examined ways in which to reverse the destruction of the planet's ecosystem while reducing global poverty. One of the few specific accords reached in Johannesburg called on nations to cut by half the proportion of impoverished people who lack sanitation by 2015. More vague statements were made pledging to minimize chemical pollution by 2020 and to better protect endangered species. However, the United States, along with other industrial and oil-producing nations, blocked an agreement which would have set specific goals for reducing the consumption of fossil fuels. When U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell addressed the summit on its closing day, his speech was interrupted by protesters angry at American policy on the environment, including President Bush's refusal last year to sign the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action, who assesses the outcome of the World Summit on Sustainable Development and his hope for future progress on protecting the environment and eradicating poverty.
The biggest no-show, of course, was the United States. There were over 100 heads of state from around the world. This was the largest international summit ever held, and George Bush simply refused to go, sending Secretary of State Colin Powell in his stead, but only to be present for the last 2 days of the summit, which was also known as the Earth Summit. And, of course, Paul arrived only for the closing remarks part after all of the agreements and deals had been cut. The United States delegation that was there was seen by most poor countries and environmentalist organizations and others concerned with poverty in the world as the state delegation that was most obstructionist in terms of trying to achieve some serious targets and timetables, particularly on the issue of reducing energy production from fossil fuels and encouraging alternative energy sources such as solar and wind power. And the final agreement, basically the United States got its way. And while there's mention of alternative energy sources, they failed to agree to the initial target that was being set, which was to try to ensure that 15% of world energy output would come from these alternative sources by the year 2010. So that was a major defeat, and coinciding with the Bush administration's rejection of the Kyoto Treaty on global warming and the fact that the United States is the world's greatest polluter, I think, is what really poisoned the atmosphere and made the United States very much the villain of this Earth Summit.
What kind of role do large multinational corporations have at these world summits on environment and eradication of poverty, such as we just saw in Johannesburg? There are many critics who say they have much too much influence.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, their role has somewhat changed. To some degree, in Johannesburg, a number of them seem to be acting as if this was a marketing event. There were, you know, huge displays put on by Mercedes-Benz or Shell Oil, all kinds of multinational corporations that, in many ways, are seen as major contributors to environmental degradation. But at the same time, there is some argument that there are even perhaps a younger generation of people from the private sector who have a stronger sense of the need to protect finite resources, of the need to invest in energy conservation and in their own sort of enlightened self-interest. The United Nations, as an international institution, has been promoting this notion of public-private partnerships for protecting environment, for promoting things like access to clean water. And there are, you know, a number of those that are sort of highly publicized. But one would have to say that the larger role is still on the negative side. And it's not just the role of the private sector and large multinationals themselves, but some of the rich governments that are really promoting those roles. So, for example, on this critical issue of access to water and access to water as a matter of human right, something the United States government has refused to agree with, you have many arguing that, well, the way to achieve access to water is through the privatization of water, one of the most critically important public resources. And you have seen privatization of public water sources in a number of countries in Africa and Latin America, here in the United States as well, and some of the devastating consequences. You've also seen a growth in people's organizations and activists fighting these privatization efforts with some success in a number of notable instances.
What kind of vision is represented among the international movements that we see among labor, the poor, and landless environmentalists and human rights advocates? In your view, will these civil society groups gain in influence in future summits, given that these summits have fallen short in the view of many?
This process that we were witnessing if you will, the positive side of globalization, which is the globalization of civil societies that are coming together to hold governments accountable for their actions and to try and rein in the power of these multinational corporations, who, in fact, in today's world are the most wealthy of all actors, who represent huge resources far greater than most economies in most of the world. As we've seen this growing series of demonstrations from Seattle and the WTO to demonstrations coinciding with the G7, now G8 summits, to the establishment of the World Social Forum that now meets annually, juxtaposed against the rich people's sort of World Economic Forum. I think these are all part of a significant trend of strengthening linkages internationally among critical civil society actors. And I think that's a very positive development.
That was Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action. Contact the group by calling area code 202-546-7961 or visit their website at www.africaaction.org. Years of giant mergers in the media and telecommunications industry have led to unprecedented consolidation of ownership and virtual monopolies in broadcasting, publishing, and on the Internet. The Federal Communications Commission, under Chairman Michael Powell, has publicly questioned the need for media ownership rules and is expected to eliminate them soon. In this environment of ever-intensifying deregulation, growing numbers of citizens are questioning the U.S. media system, which provides little accountability for powerful media owners, resulting, they say, in limited diversity of programming and political viewpoints. The airwaves belong to the public, but increasingly critics charge that the public interest is taking a backseat to the interests of big business in maximizing their profits. While the National Association of Broadcasters, the corporate broadcasting industry's most powerful lobby, meets in Seattle, Washington for their annual radio convention, a coalition of independent journalists, media activists, and community organizers will be there September 10th through the 15th to challenge the status quo and spark debate. The Reclaim the Media Community Media Convergence, organized by this coalition, will feature a series of events which include teach-ins, rallies, and direct action. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sherry Herndon of the Indie Media Network, who discusses the goals of the convergence and the importance of non-corporate, independent media.
Instead of just having a kind of a protest against the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the trends that have been going on towards more consolidation of media and loss of diversity and those trends of commercialization of our airwaves, instead of just having the protest, the organizers for this conference, we wanted to highlight a lot of the examples of powerful community media, and we wanted to bring together people from a lot of the different sectors of community media, grassroots media, independent, alternative media, and not just radio. So the vision was to kind of highlight for the community, this is what is happening, this is people's media, these are the examples of really powerful models for storytelling. So there was that motivation. There will be a number of kind of different elements for the conference itself, everything from different conversations and panels and do-it-yourself media festival and a rally. And there will probably be, you know, direct actions in the street. I've heard rumors. And we will have spaces for strategy conversations. And then also something that we're really looking forward to that's been something on the agenda from the Independent Media Center in Seattle, and that is what we call a media mixer. And that's to bring together community media makers with grassroots organizations so that we can really start to have more of a dialogue about how community media, independent media, can be more accountable to smaller organizations and getting their stories out there. We're seeing this conference as part of a trajectory and as a stepping stone in terms of building a media justice, media democracy movement. And what that essentially means for people who are listening is, to us and to many people who consider themselves media activists, is that we really feel like our ability to communicate is key in a democratic society, and that reclaiming those spaces is what the movement is about. I mean, it's one facet of what it's about.
Tell us a little bit about the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the group that's putting on this convergence, your critique of that organization, some of the things that they represent that you will be protesting.
The NAB represents advertising and commercial interests. The NAB is a trade organization and trade association that basically does not have at its core and its mission to bring to the community and bring to the people who are listening and watching television and radio anything except what is about making money. Just that piece in and of itself makes so many of the decisions about programming, about ownership, it makes it so that it does not work in the interest of the common good, the public interest. And over the past few years, the relationship between the NAB and the FCC, which is the Federal Communications Commission, which has at its heart its mandate, according to current code, that it is supposed to be, you know, regulating the airwaves in terms of the public interest, that since Michael Powell, who's the current chairman, has gotten into the FCC, and he is the son of Colin Powell, since he's gotten in there, we've seen a trend with the FCC of deregulation and cross-ownership rules, which basically allow for more and more monopolies. Where the antitrust department is in our government is a big question.
Sherry, maybe you could talk a little bit about the state of independent community media in this country. It seems that we have had an explosion of interest and activity and activism on independent community grassroots media. So maybe summarize for us, what is the state of affairs in independent community media?
One of the reasons why the indie media model has taken off in the way that it has is how cheap it is now to be able to make media through the digitalization of the technology. And that has allowed these tools of communication to get into the hands of people that otherwise it would have just been exorbitantly expensive and impossible for people to, you know, do video work and put it onto the computer and to distribute it around the world. So that piece of it, I think, is really an important element. This is just a quote that I think is really kind of cool, and I'm reading from a book by Dwayne Elgin called Promise Ahead, A Vision of Hope and Action for Humanity's Future. Professor of Communications George Gerbner recognized the power of television as the primary storytelling machine of civilizations. He said that to control a nation, you don't have to control its laws or its military, but rather control who tells its stories. And I think that what people are realizing is that they actually have the opportunity to tell their own stories again.
That was Sherry Herndon of the Indie Media Network. Learn more about the Seattle Community Media Convergence by visiting the group's website at www.reclaimthemedia.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.